On Radio Australia, this is Asia Pacific. I'm Kanaha Sababathy. Coming up, Sir Michael Somare says PNG's constitution guarantees he'll win the leadership struggle. And the Philippines authorities prepare for the mass burial of victims of the weekend tropical storm. But first, the reclusive leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, has died, aged 69. State media announced the dear leader, as he was known, died on Saturday from heart failure due to physical and mental overwork. Several hours later, another broadcast urged all North Koreans to follow the new leader, Kim's youngest son, Kim Jong-un, as Karen Snowden reports.
A tearful newsreader dressed in severe black announced Kim's death 2 days after he died on one of his many train trips. Kim Jong-il inherited power from his father, the communist nation's founder, in 1994, after 30 years of grooming for the role. He continued the policies of self-reliance and military first, under which the citizens came a poor second. Famine, poverty and forced labour camps were some of the hardships imposed by a brutal and secretive regime. North Korea is the only dynastic communist system, with the third son of the so-called dear leader, Kim Jong-un, chosen for succession. Professor Chung Min Lee is South Korea's foreign ministry spokesman and, until recently, ambassador for international security affairs. He says while others, including an aunt and uncle, will wield considerable power behind the scenes, on paper at least, the young and inexperienced Kim Jong-un will be in charge.
His son Kim Jong-un is 29 years old, and he is nominally the number two man in the Politburo and the more important Central Military Commission of the party. But unlike Kim Jong-il, his father, who just passed away, there is nobody of that stature in North Korea today. So I think Kim Jong-un's key weakness stems from the fact that he is not only young and untested, there is no adult figure to basically supervise him as he gains power in the army and the party.
South Korea's President Lee Myung-bak has spoken with U.S. President Barack Obama and called for calm, while the joint armed forces have been put on alert. During the late Kim's rule, some of the chill went out of relations with the South and even with Japan. But in 2002, U.S. President George W. Bush contributed to a deep freeze.
North Korea is a regime arming with missiles and weapons of mass destruction while starving its citizens. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
Last year, tensions escalated on the peninsula after the North was accused of sinking a South Korean naval ship with the loss of 48 sailors, and later bombed an island, killing civilians. The US and China are also keeping a close watch on current developments. Professor Chung Min Lee believes the response of the North's army, 1 million strong and one of the world's largest, is uncertain.
My gut tells me that the army is more interested in preserving their own power in the system. But you're absolutely right, the army is going to play a much more important role. And this is fundamentally different from other communist states that we've seen in Eastern Europe or the former Soviet Union. So as far as the Chinese are concerned, the worst possible outcome now after Kim Jong-il's death is sustained instability in North Korea, which they will prevent with all means possible.
And the future of North Korea's nuclear program, what can be said of that at this point?
The nuclear program runs very deep in the North Korean system. It is headed not only by the party, but by the armed forces. And the army will never give up their nuclear weapons program, regardless of who comes into power. So I think we can basically say with a fairly high degree of certainty that the North Korean army is going to keep the nuclear program, and they will not give it away.
From South Korea's point of view, for our final question, would there be hopes now in South Korea that there might be more dialogue between the North and the South?
I think in the immediate term, the answer is no. The army is on alert, but this is not something unusual in a case like this. The U.S. forces will respond in a very measured way, as will the Chinese and the Russians, I presume. So all of the key stakeholders in this particular instance want to maintain stability on the peninsula, and that is the primary goal. And I don't think any one of the actors, including North Korea, will basically disturb that stability.
Professor Chung Min Lee, South Korea's foreign ministry spokesman.
Karen Snowden reporting. Meanwhile, Australia's Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd says the death of Kim Jong-il provides a new opportunity for North Korea to engage more openly with the rest of the world. Mr. Rudd says at this critical junction in history, while North Korea's leadership enters a period of uncertainty, everyone should just watch and wait calmly.
All governments, including the government of North Korea, should at this time be exercising maximum calm and restraint, both in terms of what they do and in their diplomatic signalling. It is at times like this where we cannot afford to have any wrong or ambiguous signalling. Second, this time also presents an important opportunity for the new North Korean leadership to engage fully with the international community on how to improve their economy in order to properly feed their people, and critically, on how to deal with the outstanding problem of North Korea's nuclear weapons program. North Korea is a notoriously secretive society, and it will be difficult to read in the immediate days ahead precisely what will transpire in terms of the future of the North Korean leadership. There will therefore be considerable ambiguity and uncertainty in the days ahead, and this should be regarded as normal.
Australia's Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd. A week after Papua New Guinea's Supreme Court ruled the government of Peter O'Neill as illegal and ordered the reinstatement of Sir Michael Somare, the struggle for leadership continues. But today, there was a strong indication as to how that struggle is progressing. The nation's top bureaucrat says the public service recognises Peter O'Neill as the country's legitimate prime minister. Chief Secretary Manusupe Zurenok has told department heads to deal only with Mr. O'Neill's ministers as he has majority control of parliament and cabinet. Bruce Hill asked Sir Michael Somare if this meant that power was slipping away from his faction.
I personally don't think so. They have just issued another court to be able to interpret that they are a legal government. The Supreme Court has taken a decision and installed my government back in the office. Now, they're doing everything under the sun. They even went to Parliament so that the NEC Act can be nullified by court. But we know for a fact that court won't be able to do that. Supreme Court has taken its decision, and we are just trying to get our politics sorted out here. And our politics means that we have to talk to the party leaders, coalition leaders, and we're trying to make an attempt. We've made an attempt to talk to Peter O'Neill. So far, we have not got any response. We just heard a while ago that they have tried to go back to the Supreme Court. I think they went to the court this morning. National Court. And we will find out from the courts when they take the decision. My understanding is that everything is under contempt at the moment. Once the Supreme Court has taken the decision, any judge who sits on the National Court will have to know that the question is in Supreme Court, and I personally don't think that the Supreme Court will be able to take the decision on, because they have to sort out our problem first.
You're talking about court cases, but it seems that the government seems to be moving further and further away from you and more towards Peter O'Neill.
We have a constitutional government here, and executive arm of government, the parliament, Supreme Court, all of them are under the Constitution. And the Constitution is quite clear. And Mr. O'Neill and the rest of them are quite clear on the Constitution of this country. We know Constitution is supreme. Parliament can take legislations, but the Supreme Court, when it interpreted my installation, they made the decision that everything they have done was illegal.
Your own Attorney General, Sir Arnold Ahmed, has acknowledged that you don't have the numbers in Parliament to be Prime Minister. You're clinging, obviously, to the Supreme Court and saying the rule of law. Peter O'Neill is saying parliamentary supremacy. But even if you were recognised as the Prime Minister, you would immediately be rolled in a vote of no confidence, which Peter O'Neill would win. So The question is, even if you won this legally, you would only be Prime Minister for about half a day before Parliament voted you out. So why are you doing this?
I think let's get it straight. If Parliament goes and gets a no-confidence vote, you know that we've already passed 15 months. We got only 6 months before the general election. Automatically, Parliament will dissolve itself. I think what's the fear in their mind? They don't know that, but this is what's going to happen. And when we go, it will mean that my government would still be in government when we go to Parliament. They're trying to play around with to go to elections. They're still trying to play around with the budget. Time for budget. 2 weeks ago, we should have passed the budget. Our people are not stupid. I think our people know. And I think our guys in the Parliament are just doing what they're doing. Well, we allow. I'm sitting back and allowing court to take its decision.
But, Sir Michael, you don't have the numbers in Parliament. Parliament reflects
them. It doesn't matter, my friend. Numbers in Parliament is irrelevant when we have a constitution which is supreme. Constitution has spoken, and we're waiting for that decision. We want the decision to be taken by the Supreme Court, which is already in our favour.
Sir Michael Somare speaking to Bruce Hill from Port Moresby. On Radio Australia, you're listening to Asia Pacific. The death toll from the devastation caused by Tropical Storm Washi in the southern Philippines at the weekend is set to rise as the retrieval operation of bodies continues. More than 650 people have died and another 900 people are listed as missing in the two worst-hit port areas of Iligan and Cagayan de Oro on Mindanao Island. As unclaimed bodies begin to mount, local authorities are preparing mass graves for the victims of the landslides and flash flooding. Benito Ramos is the Executive Director of the National Disaster Risk Reduction Management Council, and he spoke to me from the disaster site at Cagayan de Oro.
We are on retrieval and relief operations and still searching for those who are still missing. The Philippine National Police, the Armed Forces of the Philippines, the Coast Guard, and the Bureau of Fire Protection. We are now right here at the Cagayan de Oro city to orchestrate the effort of the whole of government in this part of the Philippines.
And basically now that you all are beginning to retrieve the bodies, is it all a case of mass burial at the moment?
This is the discretion of the local government. That's why we are suggesting that the local government will now have a mass burial in order to prevent the spread of diseases.
And what is being done to overcome waterborne diseases? Because that is a major problem for y'all, isn't it?
We have water treatment facilities being flown from Manila to this part of the Philippines.
And have y'all been able to reach the more isolated villages?
The most isolated villages are atop the mountains, and all the victims are in the river systems on both Cagayan de Oro City and Iligan City.
And how many people are now being housed in evacuation centers?
And there are about 33,000 right now at the evacuation center. 10 evacuation centers in Iligan City and 13 evacuation centers in Cagayan de Oro City.
This is a major disaster. The death toll is very high and is still expected to rise. Why is this death toll so high?
This is because the northern part of Mindanao, the southern island of Mindanao, is not used to this kind of weather disturbances.
Some have pointed the fingers at the Weather Bureau. They are saying that basically the Weather Bureau failed to warn residents of the severity of these floods. Is this a rightful accusation?
That is not true, because as early as 13 December, while the tropical storm is still in the vicinity of Palau Republic, we have already warned our people.
And some others say the situation was made worse by illegal logging in the region. Is this true?
That is partly correct. That's why Central Mindanao, which is log-on area, contributed to the flooding down to the province of Misamis Oriental.
When can the people who are in the evacuation centers hope to return home?
It will take maybe about 2 weeks more before we can rebuild some temporary shelters.
And is the government already in the process of setting that up in place?
There is a relocation site already programmed by the local government of both cities, Cagayan de Oro and Iligan.
Benito Ramos, Executive Director of the National Disaster Risk Reduction Management Council. Indonesian authorities say they have located several more survivors from a boat that sank off the East Java coast on Saturday. Those that survived appear to have found their way to a village near the town of Blitar. Most survivors say they will try to reach Australia again by sea, and they have expressed their confusion about the Australian government's policy, which allows refugees who arrive by boat to be resettled but denies assistance to those who can't make it all the way. Our reporter George Roberts, who is in East Java, is speaking here to Tim Palmer.
We've heard now that they've found another 13 people at a place called Palu Barung Jemba, and that authorities are there now dealing with those people. They sent two boats and two helicopters to go and check other locations along the coast. So that number of 13 brings the total number of survivors confirmed now to 47. And as you mentioned, there has been some frustration here at the hotel where we are in Blitar, where the survivors are being held here. They've been upset that the Australian government had said that 87 people had been found alive when they only knew of about 25 to 30-something at the time. And that gave them a bit of false hope. They said that they were getting phone calls from relatives in Australia saying, perhaps our cousins and uncles, etc., are alive. Perhaps they're okay. So that was quite upsetting for them when they found out that wasn't the case. But the Home Affairs Minister, Jason Clare, says that he just got the numbers from the Indonesian counterparts, and that there was confusion about the numbers because it was such a chaotic situation. And that really does seem to be the case in this scenario. It's always a bit difficult to confirm exactly how many people have been found, and often in the early stages that the numbers do change, and sometimes the first thing you're told isn't actually the correct thing.
George, what are the survivors saying about what happened out at sea?
Well, they say that they were a long way off the coast. They'd been out there for a while. The boat started to list to one side. It started taking on water. They thought they were going to be okay, and then it effectively capsized. Some people tried to scramble out of windows. One guy we spoke to, a guy called Esmat Adini from Afghanistan, he says that as the boat was sinking, he managed to scramble out a small window. Another fellow that we spoke to, he lost his wife and his two children. He was crying and speaking to us in Farsi, saying that his wife had survived the first capsizing, but then another wave swamped her and a bunch of other people. And Esmat says that there were literally scores of bodies floating in the water, and those who had survived were calling out for God to help them.
Given those awful experiences and the worsening news of casualties today, what are the survivors saying to you about whether they'd attempt such a passage again?
On behalf of some of the other survivors here, Esmat Adini says that they will get on another boat if the Australian government doesn't help them. I mean, it is effectively threatening to do the same thing again, but he says they're in a very desperate situation. He says that they've been persecuted in Afghanistan. There are two groups of people mainly here, Afghanis and Iranians, and he says that they're being persecuted, they're in a desperate situation, that the Indonesian authorities aren't going to help them. And he's criticised Australian policy for leaving borders open in Australia, saying, well, if you're not going to help us, then why don't you just close all your borders and refuse anybody entry into Australia?
Our reporter George Roberts speaking to Tim Palmer from East Java. The UN-backed War Crimes Court in Cambodia has concluded its hearings for the year against three surviving leaders of the Khmer Rouge movement. The accused deny charges of genocide, war crimes and crimes against humanity in relation to the deaths of an estimated 2 million people during Khmer Rouge rule between 1975 and 1979. 3 weeks of testimony have to date shown that the most senior surviving leader, Nguyen Chia, is prepared to engage with the court, even if his continued denials of what happened sound implausible to many. Robert Carmichael reports from Phnom Penh.
In essence, the three aging defendants are accused of devising the policies that killed one in four of Cambodia's population. During the first 3 weeks of evidence hearing, Nguyen Chia, who was Pol Pot's deputy for more than 40 years, has proved himself to be a good talker, even if many don't believe what he says. As the tribunal concluded this year's hearings, Nguyen Chia, for instance, denied that the Khmer Rouge had a policy to extinguish Buddhism, Cambodia's predominant religion. It should be said that position flies in the face of the evidence. History shows the Khmer Rouge forcibly disrobed all monks, executing many in the process, and destroyed countless sacred relics and texts, and desecrated pagodas. Nguyen Chia has also continued to assert that Vietnam was mainly responsible for the crimes of the period. Last week, he said the defendants were not to blame for the forced evacuation of urban areas, a crime that constitutes a key element in the first stage of this trial and which the prosecution contends caused thousands of deaths. Nguyen Chia said leaders at the provincial level took that decision. In other words, says Nguyen Chia, the man regarded as the Khmer Rouge's chief ideologue, the leaders did nothing wrong. For many survivors, this is unconvincing stuff, says Yuk Chang, who heads the Phnom Penh-based genocide research organization called the Documentation Center of Cambodia, or DCCAM. Yuk Chang says Nguyen Chia certainly seems to believe what he is saying, and in an ideology that did so much damage.
That's why, to me, that the court, it is so extremely important to put these people on trial, because if you allow such ideologies stay alive, genocide can be repeated. Because we failed to understand and we failed to stop. And now we do understand that Nguyen Chia hasn't changed at all. After all this year, he hasn't changed a bit. He's still the same old comrade 40 years ago, same with Kyusumpon, same with Yeng Sary.
The tribunal also heard last week from former Foreign Minister Yeng Sary, but he spoke only briefly to tell the judges that he would not respond to questioning. The third defendant, former head of state Kyusumpon, said he would not answer any questions at this stage, and in a written statement went on to claim that he exercised no power at all. The voice you will hear is that of the court translator. Kyusumpon said Pol Pot appointed him to positions that he wasn't even aware of.
That is Deputy Prime Minister, Minister of Defence of nothing, or the military commander of nothing.
Each day's proceedings have been attended by hundreds of people. Among them have been many students, all of whom are far too young to have experienced life under the Khmer Rouge. Yuk Chang, who survived the Khmer Rouge's rule, says he notices that Nguyen Chia is careful to tailor his message to different audiences.
What does worry me that when there's a lot of young audience, then all we heard from Nguyen Chia and other all good things about the Khmer Rouge. You know, ideology is very beautiful, it's very pure, but he said nothing about the consequences. And when young people were not there to experience, to witness, it's kind of hard to capture unless that they properly supervised by their teacher or by instructor during the process or follow up discussion about what the defendant is talking about.
Yuk Chang believes young Cambodians see this testimony in a different light to the older generation.
It's a different perception because, you know, victim, when you have the experience, you know, you reflect differently because you were there. Most of the people that we brought to attend the trial, the villager, no one believed what Nguyen Chia had to say. They said, well, you know, we heard this before, but we were there. They killed my wife, they killed my kid, they separated me. And the Khmer was a bad people. But for young people, when they don't have life experience, and we don't want them to have such experience, because it's horrible, it requires a proper instruction to discuss, to debate.
The case of the surviving leaders originally had four defendants, but last month the court ruled that former Social Affairs Minister Yeng Tirit was unfit for trial due to dementia and ordered her release. However, the prosecution appealed that decision. Last week, the tribunal's highest body agreed with the prosecution and ordered Yeng Tirit to remain in custody for 6 months to see whether her dementia improves with medical treatment. The trial of the three other defendants is scheduled to resume in January. This is Robert Carmichael in Phnom Penh.
And that's it for Asia Pacific for today. I'm Kanaha Sibabathi. Join me again for another edition of Asia Pacific.
That was Asia Pacific for today, courtesy of Radio Australia.